Hello, and welcome to the Psychedelic Psychiatrist Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the discussion around all aspects of psychedelic medicine. This is also a space that hosts conversations about impactful personal journeys and a way to decrease stigma around these molecules and share our experiences with one another. So get ready for some deep dives and fun times. I'm your host, Juan Pablo Galindo. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. Hope you're all having a good week this week. Today we're going to take a look at the molecule MDMA and its history from where it was born and its journey over the past century to find its place now in the last phase of clinical FDA trials looking at MDMA for treatment-resistant PTSD. I've been so fortunate to be able to be trained in MDMA therapy and have been part of this last phase of the clinical trials as an MDMA therapist. But I thought it'd be really cool to take a look back in time, the origin of this molecule, and look at all the people that played an integral part in its journey. Thank you all for your support, and hope you enjoy the show. Take care. Bye. Our story begins in 1621 in Schweinfurt, Germany, when Friedrich Jacob Merck was born. The son of an innkeeper, Friedrich always wanted to be a pharmacist, and he opened his first pharmacy in Wesselburn, Germany, before moving to Darmstadt in 1668. In 1668, he acquired this pharmacy called the Engel Apotheke, which then became the beginning of the Merck Company, which happens to be the oldest pharmaceutical company known as the Merck Group today. So let's fast forward to 1827. So the Merck Group has now evolved from a pharmacy to being more of a drug manufacturer company, famously known for their commercial manufacturing of morphine. They were able to perfect the chemical process of deriving morphine from opium. They were also known to introduce cocaine into their pharmaceutical lineup, used to treat sinus problems, and add a little boost, a little kick to people with beverages. I bet. We then take our time machine to 1912 in Darmstadt, Germany, and a man by the name of Anton Kolsch is working in the laboratory. Anton studied at the University of Berlin, where he got his doctoral dissertation studying hydrozones, which have been used to create polymer foams and also can be a stored propellant for in-space propulsion. But in 1912, Anton was working at the Merck Pharmaceutical Headquarters in Darmstadt, Germany. At that time, their major competition was Bayer Pharmaceutical, who are famously known for creating aspirin. So at that time, Bayer Pharmaceutical held a patent on a molecule called hydrastinine, which was a procoagulant drug available to help with the bleeding in surgery. With that in mind, Anton's boss knocked on the door and came into the lab. He said, "Anton, my boy, so, you know, the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company, they got this hydrastinine, they're crushing the market, helping a lot of people with the surgeries and making sure that they don't bleed. So let's try to make a form of hydrastinine that we can patent ourselves to get into the game and create our own niche of the market." And with that, Anton took to the lab. He was working tirelessly day and night, looking at hydrastinine, trying to figure out an analog to somehow circumvent the patent that Bayer Pharmaceuticals held. After working for many months, Anton was in the lab one night. It was a cold winter night on Christmas Eve, December 1912. Anton had been in the lab working endless hours, and he finally succeeded in creating a hydrastinine analog called methyl hydrastinine. But unbeknownst to him, an intermediate compound was also found that night while synthesizing methyl hydrastinine. That intermediate compound was known as MDMA. It was in the description of the patent for methyl hydrastinine that this intermediate compound MDMA, 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine, was first described. It was from here that Merck filed two patent applications that described the synthesis and some of the chemical properties of MDMA. but the patent mostly focused on methylhydrazine, and that's what they were looking at to see if it could stop bleeding. However, methylhydrazine was seen to not be very effective to stop bleeding and was not seen to be able to compete with Bayer Pharmaceutical's molecule. So this molecule was tossed out by Merck, and they moved on looking for different compounds. With that, MDMA was also lost and forgotten for many years. But little did Anton know that on that night, Christmas Eve 1912, he had synthesized a molecule whose future would inevitably lead to one of the greatest breakthroughs in psychiatric care. And by the interest in this molecule, would refuel a psychedelic renaissance, paving the way for psychedelic research in all different types of molecules. So 15 years passed by before Merck came back to study the effects of MDMA. And at that time, they studied some pharmacological properties and the effects in animals, and those experiments were carried out in 1927. But alas, the results of those tests were unknown because the archives were destroyed by Allied bombing raids from World War II. So we fast forward a bit to 1953, and MDMA was again unearthed, but at this time by the United States government. At that time, MKUltra was an illegal human experimentation program designed by the CIA. They were looking at different drugs, especially LSD, to see how they could use them in interrogations to weaken individuals and possibly create this truth serum. So they injected the MDMA into rats, and the scientists noticed that they had increased heart rate, the rats were kind of dizzy, were thirsty. But at that time, they didn't use it on humans, so they kind of were just like, well, this doesn't seem to really be doing anything. And again, discarded looking at MDMA and went back to focus on LSD and see if they could read people's minds. No joking there. So once again, MDMA was cast into the shadows. Our story brings us now to a man named Alexander Shulgin, also known as Sasha Shulgin. He was born in Berkeley, California, and he studied organic chemistry at Harvard, where he had earned a scholarship at the age of 16. In 1943, Shulgin dropped out of Harvard and joined the U.S. Navy and served during World War II. After his stint in the Navy, he came back to Berkeley, California, and earned his PhD in biochemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. At that time, he had a series of psychedelic experiences that shaped his future path in studying psychedelics. At that time, he was drawn to the compound mescaline and was synthesizing various analogs from mescaline to see what kind of effects they had. So Alexander Shulgin and his wife were famously known for their books, Phenothiamines and Tryptamines, The Molecules I Have Known and Loved, which is an extensive work of their personal experience with many psychoactive compounds. So they would synthesize molecules and then try low doses on themselves and report back to see what kind of effects they had. And this book is basically an encyclopedia of their trips and their journeys with all kinds of different molecules. After studying psychedelics and experiencing them firsthand, Alexander Shulgin once said, "I understood that our entire universe is contained in the mind and in the spirit. We may choose not to find access to it. We may even deny its existence, but it is indeed there inside of us, and there are chemicals that can help catalyze its availability." In 1965, Shulgin synthesized MDMA, but at that time did not try it on himself. And 5 years later, in 1970, he actually sent the instructions on how to synthesize MDMA to some colleagues in Los Angeles. It was almost like, hey, here's the instructions to MDMA, how to synthesize it, see if there's anything there that's interesting. But at that time, Shulgin didn't really look into it that much. From there, it seems like MDMA went on its own journey and slowly emerged in Chicago as a psychoactive substance that people were starting to use recreationally. And MDMA found its way back to Shulgin in 1976. So it's 1976 now, and Shulgin is advising a chemistry group at San Francisco State University when a graduate student of his and two of her close friends told Shulgin that they had consumed 100 milligrams of MDMA and reported positive emotional experiences. So at that time, Shulgin was probably like, let's see what this is all about. I've synthesized this molecule, I sent it to my colleagues, somehow it's found its way back to me and people that have experienced it, so let me see firsthand what this molecule is about. So in 1976, Shulgin again synthesized MDMA and tried it on himself. The following are quotes from his first experiences with MDMA. "The wood pile is so beautiful, about all the joy and beauty that I can stand. I'm afraid to turn and face the mountains for fear that they will overpower me. But I did look, and I am astounded. Everyone must get to experience a profound state like this. I feel totally peaceful. I have lived all my life to get here, and I feel like I have come home. I am complete." So yeah, you know it's popping when the wood pile is looking especially beautiful to you. I just thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, he went on to say, quote, "I feel absolutely clean inside, and there's nothing but pure euphoria. I've never felt so great or believed anything like this to be possible. The cleanliness, clarity, and marvelous feeling of solid inner strength continue throughout the rest of my day and evening. I'm overcome by the profundity of the experience." So after experiencing MDMA for the first time on himself, Shulgin saw that there was something behind this molecule, something perhaps therapeutic in a sense that its psychoactive effects could have on whoever was taking it. He therefore reached out to his therapist buddies and friends and gave them this molecule and asked what they thought about it. One such friend was a man by the name of Leo Zeff, a psychologist at the time in the Bay Area. He took an experimental dose of MDMA in 1977 and said that he felt a state of euphoria that he knew had the potential to change people's minds. Leo Zeff was already a pioneer in the underground psychedelic therapy world, and he quickly took MDMA to his fellow colleagues, stating that it was, quote, "a penicillin for the soul." Leo thought that it could be revolutionary, and in a short period of time, MDMA grew a reputation for being a wonder drug and opening lines of communication, giving one a profound sense of self-love and feeling connected to others. At that time, MDMA was still legal, and Leo helped popularize it in the psychotherapeutic community, giving it the name Atom, because he believed that it returned one to a state of primordial innocence. It was in that period from the mid-70s to about 1985 that MDMA was mostly used in a therapeutic sense for couples therapy and individual therapy as well. Of note, Leo Zeff was one of the pioneers for the modern approach to psychedelic therapy. He studied ancient shamanic traditions and combined them with modern approaches to therapy to best see how to hold space when someone's on a psychedelic journey. Leo Zeff mostly worked in the underground psychedelic community under the pseudonym of Jacob. He was given credit for following a non-directive approach to psychedelic therapy, to trusting the process, and following the intuition of the person that has taken the medicine. So along with its use in the therapeutic world, MDMA also slipped into the world of the recreational community, with its profound sense of connection, sense of self-love. MDMA found a home in the emerging dance electronic community. Coming from the roots of disco, electronic music was beginning to take hold in the world, and MDMA seemed to find the home. But why did MDMA find a foothold in the dance community, you may ask? Why did it find a home in the rave culture? Dr. Zach Walsh from the University of British Columbia's Department of Psychology put it very eloquently. He said, "It probably comes down to what I like to call the peanut butter effect. Where chocolate is really good, peanut butter is super good, but when you combine the two together, it's amazing. Kind of like Reese's Pieces peanut butter cup." So there's a part of our brain called the locus coeruleus. This part of our brain detects novelty. So this part of our brain is kind of like, ooh, this is something new and different. This is something that I've never experienced before. something I've never seen before. So one of the things about music that people really enjoy is familiarity, but they also enjoy novelty in music. So if there's a new song or a new sound, it hits that part of the brain that enjoys new experiences. And psychedelics also target this part of the brain, activates this part of the brain. So the brain says, oh my goodness, I've never seen this before, I've never felt this before. And so when you combine MDMA with music, you get this double dose of novelty. You've never felt music this way before, never felt this before. And so in a sense, music and MDMA go so well together, hand in hand. And some describe the vibration of loud music in the dance club. It's almost like the music is giving you a hug while you're on MDMA. And so perhaps that is why they go hand in hand, and why MDMA found its niche in the rave dance culture. So just as the recreational users began noticing MDMA, the government also began to take notice. At that time, MDMA was still legal, and so there was these rogue drug manufacturers that would brand or logo their MDMA pills. For example, they would put the Mitsubishi symbol on them, or a white dove. And so the purpose was to create a brand for these pills. So people would kind of look out for the white dove pill, or say, oh, I had the Mitsubishi pill last time. And that's how these drug manufacturers at that time would kind of make a name for themselves. And so with these pressed pills, the name that Leo Zeth had given to MDMA, Adam, fell out of favor, and instead the term ecstasy came to be known as a street name for MDMA. At the height of legal MDMA production, this Texas group was estimated to be making around 30,000 tablets a month before MDMA was made illegal in 1985. By 1984, the DEA was growing more concerned about the growing use of MDMA, and they moved to schedule MDMA to what we call Schedule 1. So on the controlled substance list, the DEA's interpretation of what's called Schedule 1 states that when it comes to a drug that is currently listed in Schedule 1, if it is undisputed that such drug has no currently accepted medical use and treatment in the United States, and there's a lack of accepted safety for use under medical supervision, then this drug must remain in Schedule 1. So what happened was, on July 27th, 1984, the DEA proposed that MDMA should be placed under Schedule 1. However, the DEA was surprised because a number of objections came from psychotherapists, psychiatrists, and many researchers who at the time had been working for MDMA for a decade now, in a very legal sense, using it in therapy. And so the mental health practitioners and researchers requested a hearing before MDMA was scheduled to Schedule 1. But why were these mental health practitioners and researchers so afraid of MDMA being placed into Schedule 1? So Schedule 1 basically means that this substance is no good whatsoever at all, and no research should ever be done on any molecule in this category. And so once a molecule is placed in the Schedule 1, is basically serving this lifetime sentence to never be let out again. And so the researchers and practitioners who had been using MDMA thought this was unfair, because they had been using it therapeutically and safely with the correct doses and under the right guidance, and there was an accepted medical use for MDMA at that time in circles of the therapeutic community. And they believed that scheduling it into Schedule 1 would be a travesty, that it at least should be scheduled in Schedule 3, which is what ketamine is scheduled in currently, or perhaps Schedule 4. And Schedule 4, that's where a lot of controlled substances that are used day-to-day, like Xanax, Ativan, Valium, those type of drugs are all in Schedule 4. So yeah, they were trying to fight for MDMA to not be put in this lifetime ban in Schedule 1. So the hearings began in 1985 at the DEA offices in Washington, D.C., presided by the judge Francis Young. There were four hearings that year, and the judge heard several expert witnesses testifying about MDMA and accepted medical usage of this substance. The DEA heard from many therapists and psychiatrists who had been using MDMA safely for the past decade. With the correct dosing and supervision, they had not seen any long-term adverse effects. Researchers also spoke up, presenting evidence to the judge that at the right dosage, there seemed to be no neurotoxicity nor any long-term effects with MDMA usage. All right, so we did some deep dives into the actual files of the court hearing in 1985, and just wanted to present kind of the summary of the statement provided by the psychiatrists and therapists and researchers that were in favor of MDMA as medical use. So it says here, and these files are old school, they look like they were written on typewriters. So it says, quote, "In summary, MDMA cannot be placed in Schedule 1 because it plainly does not have high potential for abuse. In addition, it does not meet the other two criteria for Schedule 1 because the evidence will show that it can be safely used under medical supervision and that it has an accepted medical use and treatment in the United States." And on the other side of the coin, the DEA, in favor of scheduling MDMA for Schedule 1, says, quote, "MDMA has a high potential for abuse. It has a similar chemical structure and pharmacological properties nearly identical to substances already found to have a high potential for abuse. It is clandestinely manufactured, trafficked, and actually abused. Its lack of established safety and potential neurotoxicity make it a serious risk to the public health and safety." So looking at the papers, when it says it has a similar chemical structure and pharmacological properties nearly identical to other substances already found to have a high potential of abuse, looking at the papers, they say that MDMA is similar to methamphetamine, which is basically saying that a cat is similar to a lion. In all my years of working in the emergency psychiatric department in the University of Louisville, methamphetamine was coming in every night, all the time, and never once did I see anybody, or even hear about anybody, coming into the emergency department on MDMA. So after hearing both sides of evidence from the DEA that was in favor of scheduling MDMA under Schedule 1, and for those against scheduling MDMA under Schedule 1, Judge Francis Young ruled that MDMA should be classified as a Schedule 3 substance, meaning that the drug or substance has currently accepted medical use in the treatment in the United States, and that it may lead to moderate or low physical dependence. Also, that the drug has a potential for abuse less than drugs on Schedule 1 and 2. So I thought it'd be important to read part of the judge's ruling in regards to this hearing, just to be able to see what his thoughts were after hearing from both sides in terms of MDMA's safety and its medical use. So he said, quote, "MDMA has been utilized by some psychiatrists as an adjunct to psychotherapy. The psychiatrist remains with the patient during the period after ingesting of the substance when it might adversely affect normal functioning. All of this is in marked contrast to the manner of administering many other controlled drugs, which patients self-administer at home or elsewhere with scant regard for possible immediate contact with the physician. There are many other oral medications, controlled substances, that are not so restricted by the trained physician. The injection LD50 has been established and the oral LD50 has been reliably estimated. In toxicology, LD50 means the dose required to kill half the members of a tested population." So the judge says that doses of MDMA administered therapeutically by a psychiatrist to patients has been less than 1% of the LD50. This indicates a very high margin of safety with MDMA when it is used in treatment. He goes on to say, "Because MDMA cannot be patented, no pharmaceutical company has had the financial incentive to carry out the extensive animal and clinical tests required by the FDA for approval to market the drug on an interstate basis. Nevertheless, the overwhelming weight of medical opinion evidence received in this proceeding concurred that sufficient information on MDMA existed to support a judgment by a reputable physician that MDMA was safe to use under medical supervision. No evidence was produced of any instances where MDMA was used in therapy with less than wholly acceptable safety. Okay, so the judge ruled that MDMA should be placed into Schedule 3 based on the evidence. And so looking at data from how many people die from prescription drugs, I went and did a little research and found which medications are linked to the most fatalities in the United States. All right, so number one is alprazolam, which is Xanax, which is in Schedule 4, which according to the definition believes is less dangerous and less likely to be abused than Schedule 3. Next is fentanyl, which is Schedule 2, which still means that it's able to be prescribed. And after that is morphine, methadone, hydrocodone, and diazepam. So all of those are not in Schedule 1. All of those can be prescribed today by physicians. So that just kind of puts into perspective the biased view coming from the DEA on what they allow to be prescribed and then what they perceive as being dangerous. So everyone was really excited after the judge's ruling, seeing that he had placed it into Schedule 3 and excited about its medicinal use. And now more research could be done with MDMA, and by being placed in Schedule 3, it could continue being used in the medical world, therapeutic world, with medical supervision, with safe doses. But there's a twist in the story which I still don't really comprehend. So the DEA, upon hearing this ruling, decided that they didn't agree with that and they didn't like that. And despite having a whole year of hearings and having the judge ruling, they decided that they were going to do what they wanted to anyways and place it into Schedule 1. So I can't even imagine the frustration that the doctors, therapists, researchers, all the people that testified for the medicinal use of MDMA, how devastated they must have felt, how defeated, seeing that MDMA was placed in the Schedule 1, essentially being banned from any sort of research or medicinal use. But the story does not end here, and this story has an amazing comeback. So now that MDMA was placed in Schedule 1, essentially given a life sentence in that category, we shift our attention to a man by the name of Rick Doblin. So Rick Doblin was born in 1953 in a suburb of Chicago. He was the first of four children to a pediatrician, Morton Doblin, and a school teacher, Arlene Doblin. So Rick was always fascinated by psychedelics and its potential use in healing. But by the time he came of age, LSD was already illegal, and the war on drugs was in full effect in the demonization of psychedelics. Doblin recognized in the early 80s that he was sort of living in a similar time of how LSD was looked at in the 60s by the government and then subsequently banned, and how now in the 80s, MDMA was being looked at by the government. By his personal experiences in MDMA, he knew that this compound had huge healing potential. Doblin became interweaved with the psychedelic community, advocating for the medicinal use of these compounds. But looking back at the 60s, he didn't want to make the same mistakes that his predecessors made. He said, quote, "I do not think the use of psychedelics in the 60s was a mistake, nor do I think the alignment of psychedelics with the anti-war movement was a mistake. I think what was a mistake was the self-identification as counterculture, and that separation is self-defeating. Why have there been decades of suppression of psychedelic research? It's because in the 60s, psychedelics became linked with symbols of cultural rebellion. President Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America." So I think he's trying to say that the way that psychedelic proponents in the 60s went about these medicines, like Timothy Leary, who was very much in your face, psychedelics are going to change the world. So Timothy Leary was a Harvard professor who was studying psychedelics, who ended up being kicked out of Harvard. But he came up with the phrase, turn on, tune in, drop out. And so if you're just a regular good old American back in the 60s and you heard that phrase, you know, drop out, that was pretty scary and scared a lot of people. And, you know, President Nixon saw this as an attack on the establishment. And so how wouldn't the government respond in a harsh way towards psychedelics and LSD? So Rick Doblin was very smart about this and realized that there was a different way to go about this, that in order for the government to see the medicinal purpose of psychedelics, that there had to be legitimate research that had to come from a place of professionalism and showing that MDMA was an accepted medicinal medicine. And he wanted to do this before the drug was demonized. So as the DEA was starting to crack down, and before that trial began in 1984, Rick was building sort of a pro-MDMA campaign backed by doctors and researchers. But alas, as we know, in 1985, even though the judge ruled MDMA to be in Schedule 3 to be used as a medicine, the DEA did what it wanted and put it in Schedule 1. And so then the following year, Rick founded MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which is a nonprofit organization which was initially created for the intention of sponsoring scientific research to help pass MDMA into an FDA-approved prescription treatment. So that was in 1986 that Rick founded MAPS to be a proponent of psychedelic research to show efficacy and safety in these molecules for medicinal use. But that was just the beginning of a long, arduous road. And so, you know, it took Rick Doblin 6 years for them to even allow MDMA to be studied just from a safety perspective. So it's just to make sure that it was safe to even give someone. And then it took another 12 years before they were looking at MDMA in terms of PTSD. So part of wanting to look legit, Rick decided that he needed to obtain a psychology degree, which he obtained from the New College of Florida in 1987. And then he obtained his PhD from Harvard in 2001. All right, so Rick needed a partner in order to pursue this whole endeavor of researching MDMA. So he knew he needed someone that was interested in psychedelics, someone that was capable of flying the mothership of research for MDMA and capable of enduring the endless paperwork, meetings, protocols that this all entails. And so Rick found a partner in Dr. Michael Mithoffer, who is a Charleston-based psychiatrist who actually lives in Asheville now. But him and Rick became this team that sort of put the protocol for MDMA research together. So Rick Doblin and Michael Mithoffer worked tirelessly together for many years. So again, MDMA was put into Schedule 1 in 1985. And it wasn't until 2004 that the FDA and DEA approved for the first U.S. clinical trial of MDMA in humans. This was a randomized, placebo-controlled Phase 2 trial led by Michael Mithoffer and his wife Annie Mithoffer. So Rick Doblin and Michael Mithoffer, with the help of many others, had to come up with a protocol in order to study MDMA. So they looked into the past and saw how MDMA was being used back in the 70s and early 80s before it was made illegal, and saw that the therapeutic framework was essential in how therapists were using it then. And so the protocol that they came up with was administering MDMA while having therapists in the room and while doing therapy with the client. They came up with a male-female co-therapist pair, which then became the standard for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. And so the first therapy pair in the history of MDMA was Michael and Annie Mithoffer, his wife. And so in 2004, they began the randomized placebo-controlled Phase 2 trial. And what they did was they had patients that would take a placebo or patients that had the MDMA. And so the patients were treated with two full-dose MDMA experiential sessions, or people would get the placebo sessions, and afterwards they would have integration sessions. And they were looking at treatment-resistant PTSD. And so they actually published their initial findings in the Journal of Psychopharmacology in 2010, and they showed that in a sample of 20 subjects with chronic treatment-refractory PTSD, 83% of them no longer qualified for PTSD with the MDMA group, while 25% of the placebo group no longer qualified for PTSD at the end of treatment. Then, in a long-term follow-up study, showed approximately 75% of patients still showed meaningful, sustained reductions in their PTSD symptoms, and this was on an average of 3.5 years later from when they had their MDMA treatments. And then what's cool is we fast forward to 2017, and the FDA has granted MDMA as a breakthrough therapy. And this is looking at 107 participants who participated in the study, who 68% no longer had PTSD symptoms 1 year after treatment. And so since the classification of MDMA as Schedule I substance in 1985, there have been over 5,000 articles written about the compound in academic journals, and just over 1,000 volunteers who have taken MDMA in a clinical setting. So that's pretty astounding for a molecule to be placed in the Schedule I to where it is today, kind of this very slow grind battle for its freedom from Schedule I. And so where are we now? So nowadays, we're in phase 3 of the clinical trials for MDMA for PTSD. So that's the last phase that medicine has to go through before submitting to the FDA for approval. So now we're finishing up the phase 3 clinical trials, and so honored to have been part of the phase 3 trials here in Charleston as MDMA MAPS therapist. Shout out to my co-therapist, Wendy Reynolds, here in Charleston, who's been such an amazing co-therapist to be with during these trials. And yeah, so now MAPS is just wrapping up the data for phase 3, and the next step is submitting it to the FDA for approval, and hopefully getting MDMA rescheduled from 1 to hopefully Schedule 3. And right now, MDMA is actually in the Expanded Access program. So Expanded Access is sometimes called compassionate use. So this is for an investigational medicine that has not been approved yet by the FDA, and it's for a patient who cannot be enrolled in a clinical trial. But in the Expanded Access program, it allows for patients to access an investigational medicine prior to FDA approval. And so, wow, what a journey MDMA has been on since its first discovery in 1912 in this little lab in Germany, to then being lost for decades and rediscovered in the 50s and 60s, you know, finding its way into the therapeutic world, finding its way into the recreational world, into the rave culture, coming under the scope of the DEA and locked away into Schedule I, to slowly finding its way back into research by the hard work of so many individuals fighting for the medicinal use of this molecule, and hopefully leading to FDA approval soon. So if you want a really great book that goes into more detail about MDMA and its history, there's a book called Acid Test by Tom Schroeder, which goes into the history of psychedelics. It goes into the history of Rick Doblin, Michael Mithoffer, and also follows a veteran who goes through the MDMA trials and his experience with MDMA therapy. So that's a really great book, and I definitely recommend it to you all if you're interested in the history of psychedelics. And yeah, we've come to the end of my story, MDMA, and in a sense, it's just the beginning in terms of how it's going to help people. And I look to do more podcasts about you know, how MDMA actually works, what MDMA therapy sessions actually look like, and other things as well. Awesome. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate all of you. It'd be awesome if you could take some time to rate and review this podcast on whatever platform you're using. It really helps out the podcast, and it really means a lot to have that support from all of you. Awesome. Thanks so much. Peace, and until next time.